Hey everybody, I'm Garrett.
And I'm Melissa.
We've been married for 8 years and have two kids, Caleb and Sadie.
Over the last few years, we have fallen in love with the scriptures and are learning how digging into God's word has helped us grow deeper with each other and those around us.
We want to be real about our lives, our struggles, and our joys.
This is Growing Deeper.
Hey guys, before we get to the podcast, just want to remind you to rate and review the podcast. That'll make sure that if somebody looks up Exodus or Ruth, that they will be able to pull up our podcast and see what we have to say on different sections of the Bible. Also, if you have any questions or comments or things that you want to share with us, you can email us now. We now have an email address of growingdeeperpodcast@gmail.com. That's growingdeeperpodcast@gmail.com. Shoot us an email. We'd love to hear from you, even just saying, hey, we're listening and really appreciate it or something like that. I don't know. Shoot us an email. We'd love to hear from you. Now on to the podcast.
All right. So we are recording our last podcast of 2020.
Mm-hmm.
It won't be released into the world until 2021, I guess.
No, I'll probably put it out tonight.
Okay. It'll barely make it in 2020. And
you know, we've done 42, this will be their 42nd podcast.
Wow.
So me and you have been podcasting for a year together.
Uh-huh.
And we've done 42 podcasts.
So that's pretty cool. So that's kind of crazy. In some ways it feels like we just started, cuz it feels like we're still trying to figure things out and get the hang of it. But then at the same time it's like
about reading scripture is it's a lifelong
It's
a lifelong endeavor.
Yeah.
And you know, I guess taking it a chapter at a time like we're doing. I mean, it's going to take a while to get through it, but, you know, the idea is that me and you are reading scripture together and that maybe we can let people in on that and get other people to enjoy the scriptures too. So,
So we hope you had a Merry Christmas and, we're able to have somewhat of a normal Christmas in some sense of it. With everything going on. And I thought before we jumped into chapter 21 today that we would kind of just have a little bit of a reflection on 2020 and just kind of talk about maybe we'll stay positive with this and talk about our favorite moment or something we were thankful for or whatever in 2020. Do you want me to go first? Or?
Sure.
So for me, it actually, in a strange twist of events, it's because of COVID that my favorite memory even happened. And it was when COVID all started, it kind of forced us to be a little bit creative. And I think we talked about this on our podcast way back when it was actually happening. But we ate several dinners outside and like set up a table out there. Mm. And we did a lot more bonfires and stuff, because this was all starting in spring, so it was good weather to use our fire pit.
Yeah, and I got my little stove, my camp stove out.
Yeah,
and we did different. We may have just done that one time.
Well, we did that a couple times because our power was out.
That's right,
from the tornado.
But just
the different things. But even that, like, that was a rough time in terms of like our power was out for several days. But like that was kind of a fun, memorable thing, where we're like cooking outside because we don't have any power inside, so we're just using all of your camping gear. Mm-hmm. And stuff.
Yeah.
So that was fun, just doing the different things, that just using our backyard in a way we hadn't consistently used it before. And so that was just a lot of fun, and I think the kids enjoyed that and had a good time with that. And so I don't know, it was just a really bright spot in an otherwise difficult season.
Yeah, and I'd say for me, mine was going back to the tornadoes, and that, you know, obviously the tornadoes that blew through here, not necessarily a great thing that happened, but out of it, you know, I basically took the week off and was able to go help our community and stuff with cleanup from tornadoes. And and really, I had never really used a chainsaw before, and I learned how to wield a chainsaw like a pro, and just really enjoyed running that thing and cutting up trees and whatnot for for people around the area. And, you know, there was just something, to me, there was something really special about that, of everybody coming together, not really asking any questions as to why we should do it, just knowing inherently that we should. And seeing everybody come together, and then, you know, having experiences with these people that went through, that were in the middle of it, and seeing how appreciative they were of everything, and to listen to their stories and stuff, at, you know, what them going through the tornado, but then just getting to kind of mindlessly, you know, run this chainsaw all day long. And there was just something really kind of peaceful about it. And to be honest, it was just like, whenever I would go do that, it was like, man, I just love doing this because it's so it's just so straightforward for me.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas most of the time in my life, everything that I do every day feels so complicated, and where it just bogs me down and I get, I freeze because of complication. Like, there's just so much complexity to something, I don't know where to go, and I don't know what the first step to take is sometimes. And for that, it was just so straightforward. And so, like, yeah, we need to do this, 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 and this, and let's go do it. And you just go do it. And there was just something about that I really appreciated, and just gave me a reflection on, yeah, we didn't have any power, but basically, you know, I'm in a situation where I could just take off that week and say, you know what, I don't need to do this, you know, this week, and we don't have power anyways, and so I'm just going to drive out here, and I'm going to help people in the situations that they're in. And just how blessed we are that I was able to do that, and then also just the being blessed by the situation that we got to help other people. And yeah. So in a otherwise catastrophic event, there got to be some, you know, some good that came out of it, especially within our community, churches working together, and that don't usually work together, which is such a shame. But whenever something bad like that happens, we all seem to come together, and we become unified in a way that we're never unified. And so I just loved that. So that was kind of that's what came to mind reflecting on 2020, just the, yeah, I mean, tornado and all that. And
yeah. Towards the back of the year, towards the end of the year, I'd say Caleb getting to go back to play soccer and getting mm-hmm. to go back to preschool was probably up there for me as yeah. a top things, just because that was a return to a little bit of normalcy for mm-hmm. us. And everyone has had a wacky year, so to have a little bit of normal thrown in there was a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a ton of good that's come out of this year, and where it's been uncomfortable sometimes, there's been a lot of lessons learned from it, and realizing what we rely on and what we don't necessarily actually need, and then a lot of the things that we do need, and like recognizing that it's there, the old adage of you don't know what you got till it's gone kind of thing. And so there's been a lot of really good things that have come out of this year, and out of the uncomfortableness that's come that naturally a change makes us adapt mm-hmm. and learn new ways to do things. And we were really set up for it, to be honest. I mean, everything, technology where it is and stuff, it was, you know, we were ready to take that step. And now that's not that everybody has benefited from it. I mean, there's a lot yeah. of people that are struggling because of this.
Yeah, out but there, so. Yeah, but you're right. I mean, the fact that so many people are able to work from home.
Yeah,
that would not have been true, you know.
In the 90s, yeah. you could have never done anything like that.
Yeah,
I mean, there's not even a chance.
Yeah,
and so you know, we're kind of blessed in that way. Mm-hmm. But we've learned to adapt and learn who we are as a people a little bit more, and you know, maybe some positive things can come from that. So
here's to 2021.
Yeah.
And hopefully it won't magically be better tomorrow, but, hopefully getting to back on track with interacting with other people outside yeah, of your household. Yeah, for
sure. Maybe, hopefully by the end of 2021, we will have interacted with other people.
We can give hugs again.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
So you want to give a little bit of a recap?
Yeah. So we have gotten into what is traditionally looked at as, whenever you think of the law in Exodus, we've gotten into that section. And there's a lot of, this is a really difficult part for anybody to read. I feel like that if you kind of start with your Bible in the year thing, you know, Bible in a year, and you're about to start it coming up this new year, you're going to, if you get to this section, once you get past chapter 20, this might be where you start giving up. And so, you know, chapter 20 is the introduction of that. They're at Sinai, and God gives them the 10 words. We usually call them the 10 commandments. They're the 10 words in Greek, or in scholarship, they'll call it the Decalogue, which is just, it means 10 words. That's what the Bible calls it. It calls it the 10 words. But God gives them the 10 words, and there, to me, there just seems like that in this whole scene, you know, it's God has this desire to speak to them, but they don't want God to speak directly to them. And so then this kind of comes up, and he said, and then you get the 10 words, but in it, it just seems like it's kind of broken up into two sections, but maybe you can't necessarily do that. I don't know. But, I really see the first two commands as talking about how, to respond to Yahweh, which is, hey, he's brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slaves. Therefore, don't have any other gods before me. Don't worship any other, you know, any images and all this stuff, all these things that represent other gods. And then also dealing with, okay, so how do we interact with other people? And so we get things like don't murder, you know, don't commit adultery, don't steal. And we talked about that last week. But the 10 words is kind of, it's very, it can be a subject that you come already preloaded with what it is, but it's a response that is based off of and predicated with the fact that God redeemed them. So if we remove that from it, all of this stuff becomes like a burden. But the fact is that this is all following after God redeeming his people. And this is a gift. All of this is a gift. God is coming into relationship with them, and he's now kind of giving them a reflection of himself, of like, this is what I'm like, this is what I care about, and this is the type of people that you're going to be. And so that's what that last section is about, I feel like, looking at the 10 commands or 10 words. So we're going to kind of continue with that in chapter 21. It's going to be a lot of law, and we'll get into what I mean by law. We've misconstrued that, I think, very badly. I guess we'll just read this first section, and we'll kind of let it go where it goes.
Alrighty. So. These are the laws you are to set before them. If you buy a Hebrew servant, he is to serve you for 6 years. But in the seventh year, he shall go free without paying anything. If he comes alone, he is to go free alone. If he has a wife when he comes, she is to go with him. If his master gives him a wife and she bears him sons or daughters, the woman and her children shall belong to her master, and only the man shall go free. But if the servant declares, I love my master and my wife and children and do not want to go free, then his master must take him before the judges. He shall take him to the door or the doorpost and pierce his ear with an awl. Then he will be his servant for life. If a man sells his daughter as a servant, she is not to go free as men servants do. If she does not please the master who has selected her for himself, he must let her be redeemed. He has no right to sell her to foreigners because he has broken faith with her. If he selects her for his son, he must grant her the rights of a daughter. If he marries another woman, he must not deprive the first one of her food, clothing, and marital rights. If he does not provide her with these three things, she is free to go without any payment of money.
Okay. So, right out the gate, and I don't know that I really talked to you about this whenever me and you went over it, but it says NIV reads, these are the laws. That's not the same word that's used elsewhere. And I'm sorry for our dog.
Our dog is snoring in the background.
Yeah, it's so annoying. Anyways, it's really the word judgments or regulations. But the, and it's, mishpat is the word for it. So it's going to be the same or same like base word that's used for like justice. This is the justice, that you will set before them. And the, that word, every Hebrew word has numbers associated with it. And so the number associated with that is 7 times 6, which is, it's 42. And just so happens that the number of judgments that follow this is 42. There's 42 of them. And that's not to say that there's some secret hidden code to it of like, oh, 42, you know, like the thing that crosses my mind, oh, 7 times 6 is perfectly incomplete. that's not what it's doing. But probably not. In general, what it means, what it's getting at, it, and just like with the word Torah, that adds up to 611, which is traditionally the number of laws, or regular commands in the Torah. What it's looking at is like these are selective, and it has been ordered in such a way and selected out of some bigger group, it seems like, to make a narrative or to be put into the narrative. It's very selective. So it's not the whole thing. At no point in this are we going to see, you're not going to be able to put this all together and come up with some comprehensive law code, as we perceive of it today. 42, that 42 with the judgments and what follows seems to be like, hey, this is, it's ordered and it's put in the middle of a narrative. Mm-hmm. And so, and that's what this whole book is, a narrative. And so when we get here, we can't change our hermeneutics for it and say like, oh, well now these are the things that everybody should follow for all time. Yeah. This is something in a narrative story that is also not just, not only is it put in a narrative to tell you, to give you a point from that perspective, but it's also a covenant established with Israel at a particular point in time. And so we have to look at it in its cultural context, or as John Walton puts it, the cultural river, that it's in order to understand what's going on with this. So there's a few different things that he talks about in his book, Lost World of the Torah, is that this whole thing is structured just like the ancient Near Eastern, again, we call them law codes, but it's not legislation. There's no word in Hebrew for what we would consider legislation. It's instruction. And what it does, if you go look at other similar codes like the Code of Hammurabi, you're going to see a lot of these things repeated from the Code of Hammurabi. Things like eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, that comes up in Code of Hammurabi, which was written most likely before this. These things are things that they like, that they would understand, like that they would get. It's in their cultural river, if you would. And what it's doing is not establishing legislation, but demonstrating wisdom and the wisdom of the one that's giving it. And usually, like in the Code of Hammurabi, it was demonstrating the wisdom of Hammurabi, who's the king of Babylon. And it's supposed to be showing the people, hey, I'm wise, you should follow me, and you should listen to me. And it's these, Code of Hammurabi is probably the most copied text of this likeness. It wasn't used at all as like some judgment or law code the way that we would perceive law code. It's about wisdom. It's about seeing the wisdom of the one who gives it. And so this is in that genre, except that this is in a narrative as opposed to the Code of Hammurabi is not in a narrative. Mm-hmm. And so it's something, again, that's in their cultural river. And what John Walton would argue is that, listen, this is not meant for all people of all time. This is set in a cultural context. It's meant for wisdom, not for morality or legislation. It's meant to demonstrate something about God and his wisdom. And, you know, and so as we read these, we need to have that in our mind. And also I would argue that the Bible itself doesn't even look back at this as if it's legislation. Again, it references back to it like it's wisdom. And And it's God demonstrating his wisdom to his people and also coming into covenant with them as a suzerain king coming into covenant with a vassal, which nowhere in the ancient Near East do you have a God coming into covenant relationship with the people. So that's kind of where it's different. It's very much in the genre of the suzerain and the vassal agreement, covenant agreement. But in all other cases, the suzerain is a human person. In this case, this is Yahweh God. Gods don't come into covenant with people in the ancient Near East. They really, you know, for all intents and purposes, they don't need, you know, it's like they don't need people, and neither does Yahweh. But nowhere else do you see a God coming into covenant relationship with a group of human people. So anyways, that's loaded. And I know that that's a lot, but we have to consider that context whenever we start reading this. I mean, because right out the gate, we get past judgments. These are the judgments that he set before you. And right out the gate, we say, if you buy a Hebrew slave, and we go, slaves, like, is God saying that slavery is okay? You know, and so, like, we kind of have that, there's that immediate reaction to it because this isn't in our cultural river.
Yeah, and I think we'll see that. I mean, for me, this section was a little easier to read than the next section that we're going to, the second section that we'll read. But, like, to me, what I see in these verses is progress.
Yeah.
And I think, especially after we read this, you had mentioned that there was scripture, and I think Deuteronomy, that kind of, and we'll get into this maybe as we, don't know if you remember a specific instance, but just keep in mind that, like, some of these things, I think in the past in a previous chapter, we had said, like, in Exodus, he said to, God commanded them to not boil the meat or something.
Oh, yeah.
And then later on in Leviticus or somewhere, it says to boil.
Yeah. The first one is roast, don't boil. And then in Deuteronomy, Passover is don't roast, but boil.
So similarly, I think that there's things in this chapter. I can't, like, specifically point them out to you now, but I think you might have one example later.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think right out the gate, you know, whenever we read, if you buy a Hebrew slave, he will serve you 6 years, and the seventh year, he will go out as free for nothing, without any, he doesn't have to pay you for it. When we go into Deuteronomy, and you had a big issue with this of, like, that when we read it, you were like, well, why does the male get to leave, but the female does not, but the woman does not? And it's like, oh, you know, like, as you read it by itself, it's like, well, why would, you know, why is that the case? And, but then whenever you go to Deuteronomy, it's very explicit. It's the same thing. But instead of it being just the man, but it's also the man and the woman are set free after 7 years. And so you see the change.
Yeah.
And the, Where I'm trying to go with that is that, okay, if we see this as legislation, it can't work because it changes. And so if you've got one saying the woman can't go and you've got another one saying the woman does go, now we've got an issue with the legislation. If everything is just legislation. But that's not what it is. It's wisdom.
Yeah.
And so we're supposed to reflect on these things. Like the psalmist, he's like, oh man, I love to read your Torah. Because, man, it just fills me up. And it's not about reading it and saying, like, oh, this specifically is what God desires for me. It's reading it over and over again and reflecting on the wisdom of God as he talks to his people in their place and time. Mm-hmm. And realizing that they're at a specific place right now.
Mm-hmm.
And they're dealing with specific things. And God's not just, like, ripping them out of their culture and saying, no, be something entirely different. I go back to the, you know, I feel like there was an analogy that Ron Rogers gave one time. He was like, hey, you know, like, whenever we're trying to make changes and stuff within the church, we don't want to just, you know, it's like a magnet train. You know, you don't want to just pull the first one as hard as you can. to try to pull all the other ones along, because the magnet will break and it'll come off. The rest of the train will be left behind. Mm-hmm. But if you do a slow pull, then everybody can come along with it. And so that was wisdom from Ron, and saying like, hey, you know, like, we don't want to just rip this out and then leave everybody behind, because we think it needs to go here. You know, we think that we need to be over here in this location, and, you know, like, those people just aren't with us yet, so we're just going to say, you know, well, we don't need you anymore, so we're gone. It's a slow pull, so you can get everybody to that location in the end.
Yeah.
And so I think that's what God is doing, and he's working with people as they are, and not trying to rip them out of it, but he is trying to guide them and display his wisdom to the nations, within a group of people that are living in a certain point in time. It assumes that slavery exists in the first place. It's not trying to, you know, say that, okay, we're going to have this new moral code that, you know, now all of a sudden all the things that you've known in your life are gone. It assumes that exists in their life and how to react to that whenever certain things like that happen. It assumes that, hey, there's going to be a person that's going to come into huge debt because he's made some, you know, either famine or he's made a bad decision or something like that. He's going to have huge debt and he needs to do something to get out of that debt. Well, he's going to go to his buddy that has a lot, that actually has money, you know, that didn't have the same problems that he had. And he's going to say, hey, can you get me out of this hole? And that person's going to say, yeah, sure. And he'll pay off his debt. But the issue is that he then comes underneath the ownership of that person, because, like, you can't just give money away. You know, like, you've got to work it off, kind of thing. And so this is, like, thinking about indentured servitude. It's giving a way out for somebody to, if they come underneath huge debt, to say, how can I get out of it? They don't have bankruptcy. You know? Like, so it's to not have it would be a huge problem in their society. To not have it, to not be able to say, hey, I'm going to come underneath your servitude for you. I'm going to become your slave and you pay off my debt, and then I'll work it off for you for the next 6 years. That's kind of what's happening here. And again, we need to be respectful of the culture, not just assume like, well, why didn't you guys know that slavery was wrong? He's like, no, like, people just weren't there yet, and it takes time to get there.
Well, and I think, too, just with the context piece of it, it's like, okay, these Israelites, they were in slavery for hundreds of years.
Yes.
They know what it looks like to have a bad master, to have a master that doesn't treat them well, that where there's abuse involved, and where it's just not a good situation. And going back to chapter 20 in the Ten Commandments, I mean, you see the Sabbath day is not just for the, you know, regular old Israelites. It's also for the servants, that's too. Right. This is designed to where you're supposed to treat your servants well. And as we even see in this, in, I guess, you know, verse 5, it's like, the servant can say, I love my master and I love my wife and children and I want to stay and be a servant for life. I mean, that to me in part is going to, that speaks volumes to how the master is treating the servant. That's mm-hmm. not a situation you're probably, I mean, I guess you might would just stay to be like with your family. But if you were treated so poorly, you might would just abandon your family or try to leave and figure out a different way to get them back, to buy them back or something. I don't know.
Well, it feels like to me that somehow in the end goal of this is to actually make the person want to work for you.
Yeah.
Like to be such a good master that they want to work for you.
That you would have a servant for life.
Yeah.
And not just 6 years.
That's right. And Peter ends kind of goes to the slavery part. He says, why does the main body of regulations begin with the lengthy discussion of Hebrew slavery? Why not begin with matters of murder? In the context of the book, the reason seems obvious. The Israelites were slaves themselves in Egypt. Their first thought should be to take great care not to do what Egypt had done to them. Note especially 23:9, which is later, do not oppress an alien. You yourselves know how it feels to be aliens, because you were aliens in Egypt. If the Israelites are to take care not to mistreat aliens, they must understand that such proper conduct towards others must begin at home in their treatment of each other. And then, and the what I referenced earlier of like how the, how this exact code, we'll call it code for a second, but this judgment, which is what the actual Hebrew word is there, this judgment, whenever it's repeated in Deuteronomy, it makes an explicit thing of like, because remember, you were slaves in Egypt, you know, like, so act accordingly, you know, don't mistreat your slaves the way that Pharaoh mistreated you. So you need to have response out of what I've done for you. Remember that you were slaves in Egypt. That's step one, you know, of like remembering that. So yeah, I just, thinking about that's why it starts with slavery. It's because they were slaves. And so we need to remember that narrative context of it, that they're not supposed to, you know, it's an idea of like, hey, there's going to be times where you're going to take on slaves because that's in the cultural river that they're in. But when you have them, they have rights. And that's what this whole section is doing, is actually giving slaves rights.
Yeah.
And saying, hey, they're not just your possession. Like, yeah, you know, you own them in your cultural context, but you're supposed to treat them in such a way they actually want to stay.
Yeah.
You know?
So do you have anything else on this section? I have a few more things on this.
You go ahead.
So, well, first, I mean, I just really liked overall how this 6 years and then the seventh year going free, how that mirrors the Sabbath in terms of numbers. Obviously it's not days, it's years, but I just thought that was kind of cool. But also, I, you know, this whole piercing his ear to be the servant for life, and it just, this is where the song comes from that we sometimes sing, which is, pierce my ear, O Lord my God, take me to your door this day. I will serve no other gods, Lord, I'm here to stay. For you have paid the price for me. With your blood you ransomed me. I will serve you eternally. A free man I'll never be. And so I just think that this is just, it is taking me to this idea of serving God and willingly being a servant to him for life, because he is the perfect master.
Yeah.
And I just, this section just feels kind of beautiful to me of just, I don't know. I mean, this commitment to someone and trusting that they treat you well. And, you know, I don't know. It's a commitment to somebody when you don't have to, you have a way out here and you're choosing to stay in this servitude to someone else. And I think that that's just kind of a cool imagery, especially with this idea of then translating us to God and making that commitment to God ourselves.
Yeah.
And then I really liked to, Garrett touched on how this whole section is giving slaves rights. And, I especially liked in verse 9, when if a female slave is selected for the master's son, that he must grant her the rights of a daughter, and like how big of a shift that would be. I don't know. When I read this, I just see, yeah, it may not be perfect in how we view things culturally today, but from where they were, this is like progress.
Mm-hmm.
And so, it's just, I don't know. It's just a really cool thing of treating her like a daughter and giving her all the things that she would need, basic necessities and everything. And that, if she doesn't get those things, she gets to go free. And I think that that's just that would probably be a big deal at this point in time for them.
Yeah, and it's almost like, you know, you've got your Canaanite neighbors who are looking in on this and being like, why, you know, why don't you just, you know, treat her like the, you know, like, I guess the animal that we treat, you know, treat our women mm-hmm. like or something. And they look in on it and they're like, why are you behaving that way? You know, why are you doing that? And And the whole, again, the whole point of this, of the why God is saying that he's giving this to them, is so that they can display his wisdom. And so that the peoples around them can look in and see the kingdom of priests that are treating their slaves with particular rights that they wouldn't consider ever giving their own slaves,
mm-hmm.
you know, kind of thing. And so, yeah, it's the idea of making this female slave like your daughter. I mean, that feels pretty... It seems like it's out of the norm, maybe,
for this
cultural river again. And so, again, it's for displaying wisdom. It's not like a, it's okay to, you know, like God loves slavery. That's not the point.
Yeah, and I mean, again, you have to remember, we talked about, too, in the last chapter of not misusing the name of God and how that really means bearing his name,
mm-hmm.
and how we live our lives. And so the fact that that comes before this should tell us how God expects masters to treat their servants.
Yeah.
And also they're not really, I don't think they're in a place where they really even have servants yet.
No,
this is for like times to come once, you know, 'cause they're still just like at Sinai.
Right. It feels like it's for something out for the future.
Yeah.
Whenever they get into the land, but even this is going to be modified before they get into the land.
Yeah.
You know, like what I was talking about for Deuteronomy is before they get into the land.
Yeah.
And so it seems progressive, in that it's like, hey, this is how God works with them at this particular moment. And then as they get into Deuteronomy, it's going to change and it's going to be more filled out. And you're going to see like the whole Sabbath thing for your slaves is it in Exodus, it's about, hey, because God rested on the seventh day. In Deuteronomy, it's because everybody deserves rest is what yeah. Deuteronomy does. It says because they deserve rest just like you.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, yeah, it doesn't always feel good for us to just kind of read this. But again, whenever we consider it in the story that it's in the time that it's in, maybe that helps us understand it a little bit better and understand God. I mean, we're supposed to be seeing his characteristics in this, and that he's like, hey, we need to start caring about people. And whenever you start ordering yourselves this way, it's going to reflect my wisdom because you're an orderly, group of people, you know, mm-hmm. Order was much more important than individual rights in this time period. Yeah. The the health of the community was much more important than the health of the individual. And I think for us, that rubs against us because we're like, no, the individual matters. My individual rights matter. For them, an orderly community displayed the wisdom of the king of that community. And so it's trying to establish that so that God's wisdom can be reflected out to the world. So.
All right. You want to read the.
Yeah. One? Okay. So moving on.
Chapter or verse 12.
Yeah. Whoever strikes someone. Oh, it moved on me. Whoever strikes someone and he dies will surely be put to death. But if he did not lie in wait and it was an accident, he will appoint for you a place to which he may flee. But if a man schemes against his neighbor to kill him by treachery, you will take him from my altar to die. And whoever strikes his father or his mother will surely be put to death. And whoever kidnaps someone and sells them, or he is found in his possession, he will surely be put to death. And one who curses his father or his mother will surely be put to death. And if men quarrel and a man strikes his neighbor with a stone or with a fist, and he does not die, but he is confined to bed, if he stands and walks out in the outside on his staff, the striker will be unpunished. He will only pay for his inactivity towards his full recovery. And if a man strikes his male slave or his female slave with the rod and he dies under his hand, he will surely be avenged. Yet if he survives a day or two, he will not be avenged because he is his money. And if men fight and they injure a pregnant woman and her children go out and there is not serious injury, he will surely be fined as the woman's husband demands concerning him and as the judges determine. And if there is serious injury, you will give life in place of life, eye in place of eye, tooth in place of tooth, hand in place of hand, foot in place of foot, burn in place of burn, wound in place of wound, bruise in place of bruise. And if a man strikes the eye of his male slave or the eye of his female slave and destroys it, he shall release him as free in place of his eye. And if he causes the tooth of his male slave or the tooth of his female slave to fall out, he will release him as free in place of his tooth. And if an ox gores a man or a woman and he dies, the ox will surely be stoned and its meat will not be eaten. And the owner of the ox is innocent. But if it was a goring ox before and its owner was warned and did not restrain it and it kills a man or a woman, the ox will be stoned and the owner will also be put to death. If a ransom is set on him, he will pay the redemption money for his life according to all that is set on him. If it gores a son or gores a daughter according to this regulation, it shall be done to him. If the ox gores a male slave or a female slave, he will give 30 shekels of silver to his master, and the ox will be stoned. If a man opens a pit, or if a man digs a pit and he does not cover it, and an ox or a donkey falls into it, the owner of the pit will pay restitution. He will pay silver to its owner, but the dead animal will be for him. And if a man's ox injures the ox of his neighbor and it dies, they will sell the living ox and divide the money, and they will also divide the dead one. Or if it was known that a goring ox before, and its owner did not restrain it, he will surely make restitution, an ox in place for an ox, and the dead one will be for him.
Okay. Wow.
So that was lengthy.
So this is this section was interesting for me because I would be going along and I'd be like, okay, yep, that sounds right, and then I'd be like, whoa, this doesn't feel right.
Okay.
And then I'd be like, okay, this seems right. And then I'd get to a point where I'm like, whoa. And also there's parts of it that feel oddly specific.
Yeah.
And then there's parts of it that are left
just dangling. Wide open. Yeah. Yeah. Like, what does that mean?
Like, for example, the one that sticks out to me the most is anyone who curses his father or mother must be put to death. What constitutes cursing your mother or father?
Right.
And that to me right there kind of tells me you can't use that to legislate.
Right.
Like, you can't, like, what do you do with that if you were like a court, you know, if you're thinking about this in the court of law of just being like, okay, you have cursed your mother, so you are going to die.
Yeah.
Like, there's has to be more detail filled out for that part.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
For it to be like, okay, you're going to die. So,
which is a lot of this of this section of like, and you will be put to death.
Yeah.
And they shall be put to death. And
yeah.
You will be put to death. Instead of like the Oprah, like, you get a car and you get a car. It's like, you die and you die and you die.
You all die.
Yeah.
So it's just, I kind of go back and forth of like, okay, I'm feeling better about this, you know, just reading this. And then I'm like, no, I don't feel so good about this.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess, you know, the part that I think probably a lot of people have a hard time with is verse 20 and 21. If a man beats his male or female slave with a rod and the slave dies as a direct result, he must be punished. Okay, good. But he is not to be punished if the slave gets up after a day or two, since the slave is his property.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, wait. What do we do? Like, if you just took that verse alone.
Right.
You can kind of go, what in the world? Because, so you're telling me you can, you know, beat the slave, which already seems like we should just say no beating.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it feels like that. The thing is that it assumes that it's happening. It assumes that something like that could happen.
Yeah.
You know, it's not saying that, hey, you know, it's saying, like, we know that humans are not nice to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And so if something like this not nice happens, then let's talk about how to deal with it. Mm-hmm. You know, how do we figure out what happened, right? Anyways, I didn't want to interrupt you. So,
well, I mean, I just, it's something that's tough to deal with.
Yeah.
And I think something we talked about the other day was that, you know, as you go into the verses about a pregnant woman and how it gets down to, you know, yeah, even if they live, there's still this idea of eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. And so it's like we do have to keep that in mind, that there is this shift. And even in verse 26, if a man hits a servant in the eye and destroys it, he must let the servant go free to compensate for the eye. Or that knocks out the tooth of the servant, he must let the servant go to compensate for the tooth. So it seems like there is some sort of payment or punishment if you were to beat your slave.
Yeah.
I think it's, you know, it's just like, okay, here he didn't die.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know if it's getting at, like, is this murder or not? Is if 20 and 21 are kind of specifically talking about murder, and then as we get down into it, it's more about just, like, how do we provide justice for beatings kind of thing.
Yeah, well, I mean, in general, I mean, the first part I think is, like, it's all trying to deal with how do we determine if somebody meant to kill somebody.
Yeah.
And then what does that mean if they did mean to kill them? Okay. And then it's like, oh, you should be put to death.
Yeah.
But it's like all of it, again, that whenever it's talking about being put to death, again, this isn't legislation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It is emphasizing what's important to the people as far as, like, hey, this is a bad thing. Yeah. Like, as far as murdering somebody, that's a bad thing. If you lie in wait and kill somebody, that's bad. If you curse your parents, that's bad. Like, we don't, yeah. This is very important to God that not be the case. And
which makes sense, because we have honor your father and your mother in the last chapter. So kind of makes sense that the opposite of that would be cursing
them. Right. And so
that's bad.
And again, it's wisdom. It's saying, hey, we need to work out ways. Whenever you're sitting in the judgment seat, it needs to be important to you whether or not somebody meant to kill somebody or not.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to figure out how to discern that. And you use wisdom to try to discern that. Again, I have to reference Solomon and how he judges. Or even when David is confronted about Bathsheba, Nathan comes up and tells her a story. Or tells him a story about you know, a ewe lamb that was like a man's daughter, and, you know, he like fed it at his own table, and then, and how this other man, this rich man who had a huge flock, comes and kills this little ewe lamb that this man loves, and, you know, and feeds it to somebody else. And David's like, oh, this man should die, kind of thing. And Nathan says, you know, you are the man. But the point I'm trying to make is that David doesn't, like, go to tell the law book and say, okay, what does it say about ewe lambs that belong to somebody else that's killed? Oh, it should be returned fourfold or something like that. He doesn't, like, go and reference it to figure it out. He just is like, this is what should happen. Turns out that should happen to him, but it's all about what he did and how he was unjust. But anyways, I just say, like, whenever they go and execute judgments and stuff, they're not, like, referencing this.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is for you to study this and to think about God's wisdom and, like, learn God's wisdom through it, and saying, hey, whenever people come to me about a murder, it's not mob rules. It's what actually happened. Did this person mean to kill them or not? And if they meant to kill them, okay, that's bad. We need to deal with that. If they didn't mean to kill them, then maybe something else needs to happen. It's wisdom. And it doesn't look like wisdom the way we want it to look like. We want it to look like Proverbs. Proverbs is, like, very clear-cut wisdom. This is wisdom, too. And it's just wisdom in the form of law code. So, anyways, I think this whole first section is like, how do we figure out if somebody actually meant to kill somebody? And, you know, and if that happens, we need to do something about that. That seems to be the wisdom that's here.
Don't you just feel like that they must have had a lot of questions about bulls and ox or whatever for all of a sudden it be this shift of like, let me be real specific here.
Yeah.
Well, if you know your bull has a habit of goring, you need to lock it up.
Right, right. Like, again, cultural river. This is in the Code of Hammurabi, which was most likely written before this. These are things that they're used to hearing. It's not unique. Some of this is unique. This is not unique to the Bible. It's their cultural river that they live in that shows and displays wisdom, and they're, you know, it's showing God's wisdom in this as he's delivering this to the people and saying, hey, you know, you need to discern whether or not the dude should have known that it could have killed somebody. If it's already killed somebody before, then don't let it just hang around. You know,
it's interesting because we see this with dogs.
It's like, pit bull stuff.
Pit bull stuff. Yeah. Like, okay, if your dog bites another person, we're going to have to put it down kind of thing.
Right.
It does. Obviously, it's not.
Like, dogs get put on probation right now.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
And it's like, hey, if it bites another dog, we're going to have to put it down. And that sucks. But listen, your dog's a biter.
Yeah.
And we need to.
And it's a dog.
Yeah. And it's a dog. But this is the same wisdom,
yeah,
you know, of like how to deal with that.
I think something that has helped me kind of come to grips with the harder verses in this chapter is the fact that this is only, 36 verses? And that's just 36 verses about, like, murdering and hurting other people physically. That's not going to be enough to encompass every situation. And so, while some of this is specific, and I don't know why some of it is very specific and some of it's not, I think the main point I can take away is that this is not to be some all-encompassing thing that you follow, you know, like, word for word every time. And I think what you said is it's like highlighting the importance of these things are really bad. Doing some of these things are really bad, and something has to be done about it. And I kind of wonder, too, if, like, with the beating the slaves and stuff, I kind of wonder if the fact that they were in, like, abusive slavery for so long, if now if they have this power shift where they're the individual in power, if they think that that's just what you do when you're in power is that this is my slave and I get to treat them however I want, because that's how they were living for so long.
Right.
Of like, okay, this is what this is what the master does to the slave. That's been their example this entire time of how masters treat slaves. And so I kind of wonder if there is kind of that God is meeting them where they are of like, yeah, I know you think this is how masters are supposed to treat slaves, but he's getting to a point where he's like, you're going to have to let them go free if you, you know, hurt them.
Right. And that seems to be the case of like, yeah, if you hurt them, then they go out. It doesn't repeat it all the way through, but you kind of get the sense that, because it starts out, hey, if you strike his eye, he goes out free. If you strike his tooth, he goes out free. And then it's almost like you're supposed to follow it and be like, with what it was before, if you strike his hand, he goes out free.
Yeah.
If you strike his foot, he goes out free.
Yeah.
If you burn him, he goes out free.
Yeah.
If you wound him, he goes out free. If you bruise him, he goes out free.
Yeah.
So it's like it's almost like it was kind of it set the pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the next line, whenever it talks about the slave, it doesn't go all the way through it, but you get the sense of the pattern. You feel the pattern of like this is not acceptable to treat your slave this way. Whereas before, it was trying to discern, is it murder or not?
But again, it's giving people, I know it might not seem like it, but it's really starting to give people rights.
Yes.
The women who are not looked upon greatly in this culture are like protected from men just hitting them and stuff, you know, like that there is some sort of consequence to that,
mm-hmm.
that there is some sort of consequence for hitting your servants, for treating your servants for poorly, for hurting other people, for treating other people poorly, there's a consequence. And so it's, those consequences can seem harsh and seem scary, but at the same time, for the vulnerable people, it protects them.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I don't know. I think we just have to reevaluate our perspective on how we're looking at these verses and really trying to remember the whole, it's so hard for me to like remember the context of even just like, I keep trying to reference the chapters before because I have to remember this is a whole story, right? And not just like reading this chapter in isolation.
Yeah.
And that is something that has always been so hard for me to do. I'm getting a little bit better at it, but there's so much of the Bible that I don't know on this level, especially in the Old Testament, like with Deuteronomy and Leviticus, where we see some of these themes repeated or, you know, progressing,
mm-hmm.
that I haven't even read yet,
yeah.
if I'm completely honest, that yeah. I've never read. And so I don't... That limits me in some aspects of how I'm studying this, but hope, I mean, that's why we do it though, is
that's right.
We're trying to get to a point where maybe we'll view this chapter even differently as we continue, you know,
yeah.
And to new books and whatever, you know.
And I think as we go along, I think one thing that'll really help is to also think about, how does the rest of the Bible view this text? And how does it use it? And it never uses it as legislation. Doesn't use it as law code. I can't mm-hmm. emphasize that enough. But a guy like Micah, which we have read together, a guy like Micah reflects on the Torah. And whenever leadership is mistreating and abusing the people that it has, you know, or that it is over, the people that they're supposed to be serving, whenever they're abusing their role, Micah looks at Judah and, you know, that group of people, and he says, guys, what has God asked of you, right? What has God asked of you but to pursue justice, to love steadfast love or love loyal love, and to walk humbly with him? What has he asked of you? And you could, if you see this as legislation, you could respond and say, well, dude, he gave us 611 laws that we were supposed to follow to the T. But no, what Micah is doing is he's summing up all of this and being like, guys, the wisdom of Yahweh is that you seek out justice for people.
Elevating yeah. those oh, who are vulnerable.
And that word is mishpat, yeah. which mm-hmm. is where this began. The mishpat of Yahweh. This is the mishpat of Yahweh. And he says, you know, what has he asked of you? But to seek justice. To love mercy or to love steadfast love and to walk humbly with him. That's how he sums up the whole of the law. So that's one thing, one way we can look at it and try to reflect on what is this text and how are we supposed to use it, is to use it the way that Micah uses it. And he reflects on it and says, like, God seeks justice for people, for those that are less fortunate, those that are in positions of less power. And then to take it a step further, to say, well, what in what way does Jesus use it? In what way does Jesus reflect on the Torah? And he says, hey, I'm not here to abolish the Torah. I'm here to fulfill it, to fill it up. And the way that he would use it, he would say, what does all of it hang on? Well, love God, right? With all of your heart, with all of your being, and all of your, you know, all of your muchness, all of who you are. Love God. And then love your neighbor as yourself. All of the Torah hangs on these two things. And so he reflects on it and he says, all of it filters through that. And so if we're not using that lens, we're not likely going to read the Torah the way that Jesus is saying we need to read the Torah. And then if we go and look at how, I think it's really, I think this is a really cool thing. And maybe I'll end it with this, and maybe in other episodes we can go into how, like, Paul deals with it. But I'll end it with this. Whenever Jesus is confronted by the teachers of the law, the teachers of the Torah, when he's confronted with them about some things that he actually said in the Sermon on the Mount, which is concerning adultery, in that he says, hey, listen, you know, if you if you divorce your wife and stuff, like, it's way worse than what you think, kind of thing. That you're actually putting her in adultery, you yourself are in adultery, and stuff like that. He takes it to the whole nother level, the same way that he does for murder. He says, if you hate a person in your heart, you've committed murder. And so he reflects on that, reflects on this idea of adultery and says, hey, it's a whole nother level. And the Pharisees come to him in Matthew chapter 19, and this is what happens. It says, and Pharisees came up to him in order to test him and asked him if it was permitted for a man to divorce his wife for any cause. And he answered and said, have you not read that the one who created them from the beginning made them male and female? And said, on account of this, a man will leave his father and his mother and will be joined to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. So then they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, man must not separate. And they said to him, why then did Moses command us to give a document, a certificate of divorce, and to divorce her? And he said to them, Moses, with reference to your hardness of heart, permitted you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it was not like this. Now I say to you that whoever divorces his wife, except on the basis of sexual immorality, and marries another, commits adultery. And whoever marries her who is divorced commits adultery. And okay, so we can, there's a lot of stuff that we can do wrong with that. But here's in general what I think is being addressed, and it's a lot of how do we approach the Torah. And they approach the Torah, so whenever they come to Jesus, they're saying, hey, you're telling us that we can't divorce our wives, and Moses allows us to divorce our wives, so what's up with that? And so they're saying the law permits it, so therefore it's okay, right? And Jesus is like, no, guys, like, you're missing the point. Like, why is it in the Torah in the first place? Well, because your hearts were hard. And so God was working. And it seems to me that what Jesus is getting at is that he's saying, listen, God was working with a people in a place and time where they weren't ready to hear this from Jesus. They weren't ready for it. And so he's working with a group of people, and because of their hardness of heart, which is, it's funny, I mean, that the whole Torah, the way that hardness of heart works.
Pharaoh,
it's emulating Pharaoh and saying, look, you know, even whenever they're delivered, and God gives them all these commands, they still can't follow them. And because of their hardness of heart, God gave them, you know, he's giving them stipulations based off of where they are in their context. And so I think when we reflect on the Torah, it's not supposed to be like a, this is okay for, you know, God thinks this is okay for all time. This is something he's working with a group of people, and Jesus seems to agree with that. And it's like, hey, that was said because you guys are hard of heart, and you can't, like, you're not listening to God. And instead, the Torah was meant to highlight that, and not that, hey, here's the perfect stipulations of God. If you follow all these things, then you'll be saved. That's not what it's for. It was to the story of the Torah seems to be that no matter what commands God gives them, whether they're easy or not, they can't follow them, and they refuse to follow them. And the point seems to be that whenever, and what Moses says the point is that, guys, your heart needs to be circumcised. And it's commands aren't going to change you. Getting these new commands aren't going to change you. You need something different. You need something more. And that's what Jesus is saying. He's saying that too, is that, and again, he takes it to a whole nother level the same way that he does for murder. But the point isn't that, well, you're screwed if you've done any of this. The point is that Jesus coming, he's like, I'm going to change your heart, and I'm going to do something new, and something, the thing that always needed to be done in order to get you where you need to be. And so that we can actually listen, so that we can actually listen to God. The commands weren't doing it. And I compared it to, it's kind of like with Caleb, we, you know, our 4-year-old son who, you know, there's certain situations where I could give him a, like, more perfect command of what to do, but he'll never understand it. Like, he wouldn't
be able to... He'd go, what'd you say? Yeah, he'd be like,
What'd you say? So, in order for me to get him to do certain things, I have to bring it down to his level where he can understand. And even whenever I bring it down to his level, there's a good chance he's not going to listen to me anyways. And so, which is kind of, that's kind of the story of the Torah. God is working with people and with the level that they are. And the fact is that they continue to not listen, even when the commands are good. And so, you know, I think that it kind of helps me give reflection on the Torah and what its purpose is. And Paul would say, it was so that I could, my hardness of heart could be revealed, so that I could see that we were sinful. The point of the Torah was to unveil that and to show that even when God would give us commands that were easy to follow, which is what Moses would say, that, hey, this isn't too far off that you can't grasp it. It's right there before you. And yet, for some reason, you refuse to grasp it. And it's because we have a hard heart. There's something needs to be done about the hard heart. That's what the Torah is about. And so I think whenever we reflect on it that way, we stop treating it like it's commands for all time that I can go through and just extract the one that I want for my particular situation. We got to quit doing that.
Well, and also just like the fact that this is part of the Torah is to show us why we need Jesus.
That's right.
So, you know, keeping that in mind too.
And it's setting the pattern.
Yeah.
So that whenever Jesus stands up there on the Sermon on the Mount and starts giving Torah, he starts giving instruction, just like Moses did. It's setting the pattern. And saying, like, because without it, now, like, we can't know what, you know, whenever Jesus comes on the scene, it's something like, I mean, they wouldn't have known what they were watching. Mm-hmm. Instead, because they had Torah, because they had the prophets, it was looking forward to something so that whenever Jesus came on the scene, it was like, oh, this is our God.